the incredible awkwardness of going from being gentrified to being a gentrifier.
And people were giving me that same look that I recognized from my own experience, that kind of like, what are you doing here look, which I had been giving people in the West Village when I came back from college, to all the millionaires with their Fendi bags and fancy dogs, you know, just kind of this curious look of, you know, you seem like you don't belong here.
That's Peter Moskowitz. We talk with him about his book, How to Kill a City: Gentrification, Inequality, and the Fight for the Neighborhood. Then we talk with someone who got gentrified out of Soho in New York City. But before he leaves forever, he's mounted an exhibit in honor of some of the area's most famous residents.
The thing is, to me, they all did the same thing. They all created a new medium because they wanted to be able to change the world, especially in a way that made it fairer to the average person. And they realized that regular language wasn't going to do it. They had to come up with something else.
That's Steve Stolman talking about the Mulberry Street Gang, Teddy Roosevelt, Mark Twain, Nikola Tesla, Jacob Riis, and Joseph Kepler. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. What happens to a city when it turns into a place where only the rich can live? When the mom-and-pop stores are replaced by upscale chains, Starbucks is on every corner, and diverse neighborhoods become white-only enclaves of CEOs and hedge fund managers. Or at least their wannabes. It's called gentrification, and it's supposed to be the great force revitalizing American cities like New York, New Orleans, San Francisco, and Detroit. But guest Peter Moskowitz says gentrification, far from revitalizing cities, actually kills them. It's like a ladder that pushes everyone down a rung until only the rich are left. But all the reasons why the rich want to live in a city in the first place have gone away with everyone else. Interesting neighborhoods, ethnic diversity, artists. We tend to think that gentrification is a natural process. So whether we like it or not, we have to accept it. But Moskowitz says it's anything but natural, driven by urban policy that favors the real estate industry and abetted by plunging taxes on the wealthy. Gentrification, Moskowitz says, is trickle-down economics in urban form. Peter Moskowitz is a journalist and writer based in Philadelphia. His work has appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, Vice, and New York Magazine, among other publications. How to Kill a City is out from Nation Books. Peter Moskowitz, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, you grew up in the West Village in the 1980s, and you say right at the beginning of How to Kill a City that you are both the gentrified and the gentrifier. What do you mean by that?
Yes, so I grew up in the Village, right on the West Side Highway where the Hudson River is, and my parents, in a way, were kind of the first wave of gentrifiers, if you want to call them that. They lived in this loft building that had been converted from a warehouse, and before that, the neighborhood was mostly industrial. I still remember waking up in the morning to the smell of fresh garbage, because there was a garbage truck parking garage next door. But in many ways, the neighborhood was really like an ideal place to grow up as a kid. I could walk to school because I knew people along the route. You know, I hung out by myself or with friends, you know, from the age of 10, 11 onwards, just out in the neighborhood, because it was really kind of that eyes on the street model of neighborhood living that the famous urbanist Jane Jacobs talks so much about. And Jane Jacobs wrote her book, Death and Life of Great American Cities, about three blocks away from the apartment I grew up in. But by the time I was an adult, the West Village had kind of become a funhouse mirror version of itself. you know, these brownstones selling for $5-10 million, all the small antique stores turned into Marc Jacobs or Michael Kors or other designers, you know, the pizza places replaced by juicing places. Really, it's even nowadays hard to get a meal for under $15 there. And so the average rent for a one bedroom apartment in the West Village is now $3,500. So when I came back from college, I wanted to live in New York. I was an adult. I didn't want to live with my parents anymore, but I couldn't afford to live in the Village. So I ended up moving to Brooklyn. Well, first Queens and then Brooklyn, and kind of found myself on the other side of the coin where I was the new face of the neighborhood. I found myself frequenting stores that, you know, I would go to and my friends would go to and other white people would go to. But I noticed that the, you know, African-American residents of Bedford-Stuyvesant wouldn't frequent. And people were giving me that same look that I recognized from my own experience, that kind of like, what are you doing here look, which I had been giving people in the West Village when I came back from college, to all the millionaires with their Fendi bags and fancy dogs, you know, just kind of this curious look of, you know, you seem like you don't belong here. So that's how I got really interested in this dynamic and in the word gentrification itself, because I saw myself as both a victim and a perpetrator. And I knew if that was the case, then it had to be a bigger process than just, you know, coffee shops and hipsters and the ways we usually hear about it, that it had to be something much larger than that.
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest surprise to your book for me, and probably for many readers, is that I think most of us assume that gentrification is a kind of natural process. You know, my mother was an artist. She bought her loft in an artist's building in Soho in 1974. You know, the idea that I grew up with, the urban legend I grew up with, is that the artists moved in, they squatted in Soho because the factory lofts were going empty because they were going down south, and that, you know, the brave artists had to fight the city for the right to stay there and to get artisan residence lofts.
Mm-hmm.
You say it was a lot more deliberate process than that, both in Soho and New York in particular, as well as in general. So tell us about that.
I do think there are several different forms of gentrification. And, you know, what you see now where, let's say, Michael Bloomberg redevelops an entire swath of the Williamsburg waterfront for 30-story condos. That kind of gentrification is obviously slightly different than artists moving into Soho. But I do think that in both cases, they're similar in the sense that they're more top-down than people might realize. Back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, New York City was really trying to deindustrialize itself. And that process actually goes back over 100 years to a plan hatched by politicians and bankers at the time to clear Manhattan of its industrial zones, move all the industrial zones to the outer boroughs, so that way bankers and real estate owners could sell Manhattan real estate at higher prices. So that's been a plan for over 100 years, and you kind of just started to see it come to fruition in the late 60s, 70s, and 80s, when the city essentially rezoned large swaths of the city, converting them from industrial use into commercial and residential use. And they also did things like target Soho with, you know, fire inspections that many believed were unfair, kind of just made it really hard to run an industrial operation in the center of the city. And there's a survey, you know, I don't remember the exact numbers from it, but Sharon Zukin, a professor of planning at NYU, did this survey and found that the majority of industrial manufacturers in Soho would have stayed in Soho if they could have, if the city had allowed them to. So it wasn't just artists moving into this abandoned neighborhood. The neighborhood became abandoned for a reason, and that reason is the government.
And now Soho is basically one of the biggest outdoor malls in the United States. Talk about the purpose of gentrification at heart as being a means for basically promoting capital growth.
Yeah, so you have to go back to how cities are funded these days. If you look at the 70s, 60s, really any decade before that, back to the 20s, the federal tax rate on the richest people was sometimes 90%, sometimes 80%, sometimes 70%. The federal tax rate, the top tax rate, income tax rate right now is around 35%. And with all the loopholes and everything that most wealthy people work into their taxes, it's, you know, closer to something like 15%. So what do taxes pay for? They pay for schools, they pay for roads, they pay for public housing. How did New York build enough public housing to house almost a million people back in the 40s? Through high taxes. So now cities are kind of in this conundrum. How do you fund the New York City Public Housing Authority if you don't have any tax revenue? How do you fund the subway system without taxes on the wealthiest people? You essentially have to bring in as many wealthy people and as much capital as possible into your city and state in order to regrow your tax base. So instead of, you know, charging a couple of billionaires high rates, you have to bring in as many millionaires and 100,000-aires as possible so they can pay property taxes to essentially fund your municipal government. So that's that. You know, that's not directly how you get a neighborhood like Soho, but New York City has no reason to want to do anything different with Soho than what it's become. Because as of now, if Louis Vuitton or Nike is paying, or Apple is paying literally sometimes $100,000 a month or more in rent, that tax revenue is going to the city. That's funding public schools. So the city has no incentive to try to save a neighborhood or make it livable for its residents, because it's good for the city if the neighborhood is essentially just a mall.
You say Nike. That strikes home quite personally to me, because there's a new Nike store on the corner of Broadway and Spring Street, which is one door away from the building that my mother's loft is in. I mean, she's passed away, but it still operates as an artist building, and there's still a dance studio there. We had a big fight. We were all quite sad when that building went in on the corner, because what got torn down was a marvelously quirky building with little hidden Warrens, small stores in it that were really unique to themselves. On the first floor, there was the Cafe Barry, I believe it was. But above that was just a building that you could not ever find in New York City now, much less in Soho anymore. That's a process of a kind of blandification of the city. And when your title, How to Kill a City, really gets to the heart of that. So how are we killing cities by doing this, by gentrification?
I think there are several ways that we're quote-unquote killing cities. And I think it's important to point out that the most direct way can literally be through death, like a person's death. If you look at New Orleans, which is one of the four cities I explore in the book, the gentrification of that city was built upon the removal, the forcible removal of tens of thousands of African-American residents and the death of over 3,000 during Hurricane Katrina. Right after Hurricane Katrina, the governor at the time, Kathleen Blanco, said it took the storm of a lifetime to create the opportunity of a lifetime. And real estate investors poured into the city. A conservative government demolished every single public housing project in the city. They turned every single public school except for four into a charter school. And they didn't give enough money for poor black residents to come back. And there was even a lawsuit against FEMA for not adequately distributing funds and giving rich white people more funds than poor black people. So when I say How to Kill a City, you know, in that sense, I'm really talking about, this is about death and destruction of a city, of a people, of a culture. In New York, it's not as blatant as that necessarily. You know, you're not seeing forcible removal necessarily. But what you are seeing is, you know, blocks and blocks of real estate being sold off to the highest bidder without regard for what those blocks become. So if you go to Bushwick, where many immigrant families once lived, you'll now see these ugly condos that look like they could be in Miami or Chicago or LA or really anywhere. And if you go to Soho, you know, if you spin around three times, you might be on, sorry, I'm forgetting the name of that boulevard in Los Angeles where all the famous people shop. But yeah, if you spin around three times, you might be there, you might be in a mall. There's really no regard for how a neighborhood works anymore. You know, and as Jane Jacobs talked about, you need diversity in all forms in order for a neighborhood to work, in order for it to not become bland, in order for it to not require massive investment from the government. Because the reason I was able to walk to school when I was 10 years old is because it was not because of a police force, but because there were people that I knew along the route. Now, if you're in Soho, you might not know anyone. The only people there might be the hourly workers who you know, take the train in to work at that Nike store, and you know, it becomes this anonymous neighborhood that loses so much value, even as it gains so much monetary value.
Yeah, you liken gentrification to a ladder that pushes everyone down. You know, the poorest people get pushed off the ladder, but it's not even good for rich people.
Right. That was Ruthie Dacola, this activist in New Orleans, was the first person who kind of told me that metaphor, which I thought was really a good way to sum up gentrification. It puts the squeeze on everyone. When a city becomes essentially a corporate entity, what happens is that everything becomes a commodity, and whoever can afford the most commodities can live the best life. But the problem with that way of thinking is that once everything is commodified, there's no culture, there's no soul to a city. So you even have, you know, I forget the name of the woman, but she's one of the heads of Forest City Ratner, which is one of the hugest developers in the city. They did Barclays Center. They do some of the biggest, most controversial developments in the city. And she even said, "I'm worried about Brooklyn losing its edge if we develop too much." So, yeah, even the wealthiest people, even the developers, are scared that if gentrification keeps you know, demolishing neighborhoods and kind of stripping them of what makes them great, that they won't be able to make a profit anymore because no one will want to live there. And Jane Jacobs talked about that too, about success destroying success, essentially. That if everyone wants too much of the same thing and there's not enough of it, then you get neighborhoods like Soho or neighborhoods like the Village today.
Well, since you've mentioned Brooklyn, let's stay with that a little bit, and then we'll go back to New Orleans and Detroit as well, two of the other cities you look at. I don't know if we'll have time for San Francisco, but Brooklyn, you say, has become the least affordable housing market in the United States. That's a real shocker. We have a mayor. Mayor de Blasio is running for office. He ran and won on the issue of income inequality, A Tale of Two Cities.
Right.
You would think that he would have, you know, I mean, he's talked a lot about the crisis, housing crisis in New York, the crisis of affordability. What has he done to address it?
I'm not a de Blasio fan, to put it mildly. The general problem is cities are addicted to this method of self-funding. You know, in the eyes of someone like de Blasio, there's no way to run a city like New York without encouraging development, because development is what pays the city's bills. Especially nowadays, when the city has no industry to speak of, it has a small movie industry, the fashion industry is kind of there, but there's no manufacturing. It's really essentially an entire city built on real estate value. So in order to fund the city, de Blasio feels he has no choice except to encourage development. And to that end, he combined the Department of Housing and the Department of Economic Development into one department, which in my view kind of gives it a conflict of interest, and hired Alicia Glenn, whose last position was as investor for Goldman Sachs in urban neighborhoods. So that gives you an idea of her politics. And she now heads that department. So their method of trying to house everyone, and I do believe they have good intentions, or they think they're doing the right thing, but their method is essentially to try to piggyback on pro-capitalist development in order to provide for the poor. So instead of building things like public housing, they're requiring developers who build huge condo complexes in poor neighborhoods to set aside 20 or 25% of that housing for low-income people. And in exchange for doing that, they get to build bigger than they would have without that housing. So I don't know if you see these stories crop up, but, you know, a housing lottery will open for a new rental complex in, say, Williamsburg, and they'll get something like 80,000 applications for 30 apartments. That shows you how insufficient the strategy is and how much more needs to be done. But unfortunately, de Blasio is not anti-development. He's not saying, let's put the brakes on what's happening. He's saying, let's go full speed ahead. And also, if we can, we'll throw in a little bit for the poor while we do it.
It's kind of like Reagan's trickle-down theory.
Right. I mean, and that's what gentrification is, essentially, is trickle-down economics in city form. The idea that rich people will provide everything a city needs and poor, you know, poor people will, you know, grab onto a few dollars from that.
And where are the poor folks going? Not just in New York, but in the other cities that you look at.
So more and more low-income people and immigrants are moving to the suburbs and exurbs. If you go to, you know, random towns in central and northeastern Pennsylvania, you'll likely see huge populations of Central and South American immigrants. Make the Road, which is a longtime nonprofit in Queens, which serves Latino immigrants, recently opened its second office in Reading, Pennsylvania. So that gives you an idea of where the people they serve are headed. And if you look at San Francisco, for example, people are living an hour, 2 hours away by train or by car. And cities essentially are just becoming these jewel boxes that are meant for tourists and the rich and those who serve the rich, i.e. like the creative class, and everyone else is kind of bust in to make the city function and then bust out every night.
And are the exurbs and suburbs revitalizing themselves, or are they? Do they have any more public funds than cities do to fund roads and schools and hospitals and fire departments?
I mean, to a large extent, they are being held together. You know, I think without this mass exodus from cities, suburbs would be in a lot worse shape, because suburbs were kind of a ridiculous idea in the first place, and, you know, aren't really conducive to, you know, to kind of being reused in the same way that a city block is. So I think the fact that it's not a good thing at all that people have been forced out to the suburbs, but, you know, they are thriving. If you go to a lot of suburbs, they have, you know, their own, you know, mini Chinatowns or Koreatowns or, their own, like, mini ethnic neighborhoods. The problem is, though, that suburbs were essentially built to accommodate wealthy people with cars. And if you don't have a car, if you can't afford to drive everywhere, if you want to live close to family, if you rely on services like nonprofits like Make the Road, that's all harder to get in the suburbs than it is in a city.
Well, Peter Moskowitz, in your book, How to Kill a City, as we've mentioned, you look at several cities in detail. The example of New Orleans is quite shocking. People were really discouraged from coming back, and you tell a number of stories. One of them is of a man named Henry Glapion. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Yes.
Tell us his story.
Oh, sure. So
Wayne Glapion? Okay.
Yes. So he is a jazz musician and was born and raised in New Orleans in and his parents owned a shotgun house, a double shotgun, which means two kind of railroad style apartments with separate entrances under one roof, which is the most common style of house in New Orleans. And it was damaged during Katrina. And he was evacuated and ended up, I forget exactly where, it's been a while since I've read that section of my book, but essentially had to claw his way back to the city, hitchhike back. Only got back because a nice couple that saw him on the side of the road gave him money to rent a car to get back to the city. It took him days and days to get back there, and all he wanted to do was rebuild that house. When he got there, he was essentially told that he would be shot if he was caught by the National Guard. The city was essentially on lockdown, but he kept coming back. He kept trying to repair the house. He would drive 5 hours away to take a shower once a week at, I think, his cousin's house. And then finally, he got back, but he didn't have enough money to finish repairing his family's house. And FEMA wouldn't give him the amount of money needed to make the repairs. So he ended up selling it to someone who converted the two apartments into a single-family home. And now he lives further out, still in the city, thankfully, but in a further out neighborhood.
I mean, I think what shocked me the most is he came back to repair his own house and was repeatedly threatened with jail or worse.
Yeah, exactly. There was a pretty direct and concerted effort to keep poor black people out of the city. And, you know, there were several murders of African Americans at the hands of police right after Katrina, including Henry Glover, which is an infamous case. He was found, his body burned in the back of a police car, and those police were all eventually, none of them currently are serving jail time. Some were convicted, but they were all released. And the Danziger Bridge shootings, in which several people were shot by police, even though they posed no threat. There was essentially, you know, depends who you ask, but in my opinion, a purposeful climate of fear that politicians in particular did not want these people coming back.
And it was more than just housing. You talk about the privatization of the schools, how, you know, the schools after Hurricane Katrina were all made into charter schools. This is something that Naomi Klein has talked about as disaster capitalism. How was the privatization of the schools part of a key part of gentrification?
The privatization of the schools helped gentrify the city in some subtle ways, like, for example, the system of school choice that charters use often means that kids now have to be driven by their parents all the way across to the other side of the city, and that places a burden on poor parents. But there are things like a lack of extracurricular activities, which, you know, also means that poor parents might have to stop working earlier in the day and to pick up their kids and things like that. So that essentially places an undue burden on low-income families and often convinces people to search for schooling in the suburbs. But there are some really direct ways that it contributed as well. First and foremost being that when they basically created this rubric for if a school is failing or not right after Katrina, that just happened to categorize every single school in New Orleans as failing and no other school in the state as failing. And that allowed the state to take over the entire school system and fire every single teacher in the New Orleans school system. So something like 8,000 teachers were fired. And if you think about that, that's 8,000 unionized jobs in a city of about 450,000. So 8,000 families making middle-class salaries, the vast majority of them African-American, fired. And most of them were replaced by low-paid or volunteer teachers, mostly white, mostly from the North, working for nonprofits like Teach for America. And those people have now stayed in the city and gotten full-time jobs at these schools and have kind of replaced the black middle-class workforce that was there before them.
And there's also a profound impact on what you call a vital tradition of black activism in New Orleans. Why did that go down?
So a lot of the black activism in New Orleans was centered around public housing in the St. Thomas projects, for example, which is now called River Gardens and is owned by a private developer named Prez Kabakoff. In that development, there was one of the first in the nation tenant councils where tenants were coming together to organize, to demand changes to public housing. There was a network of nonprofits that was working with public housing tenants. There was a lot of anti-police brutality work being done. And then because they demolished those projects and replaced them with essentially single-family homes, some of which are set aside for poor people, but a lot of which are not. People are just spread all over the city or haven't even returned at all. So one of the main leaders of that public housing movement now lives in New Orleans East, which is this suburb that the only way to get there is by getting on a highway. And it's about 20 minutes from downtown. And he just like lives this isolated life where, you know, there's no way to organize because there's no one there to organize with.
Peter Moskowitz. We'll talk more with him about his book, How to Kill a City, after the break. Stick around. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today with journalist and writer Peter Moskowitz about gentrification and its discontents. His book, How to Kill a City, is a brilliant examination of how gentrification is destroying neighborhoods and contributing to inequality. It examines the issue through the lens of four major U.S. cities: New York, New Orleans, San Francisco, and Detroit. We spoke about New York, and we mentioned de Blasio talking about A Tale of Two Cities. A tale of two cities even more extreme than New York is Detroit. I think a lot of us have heard about the revitalization of Detroit, and Detroit is coming back. It's becoming a center for the creative class. Well, it's only a really, really tiny bit of Detroit where that's true.
Right.
And the rest of Detroit is still losing people. Tell us about The Tale of Two Cities of Detroit.
I think this is something a lot of people don't understand about gentrification, that it doesn't have to be like San Francisco or New York where the displacement is right on top of, you know, that, you know, new people are coming and replacing people directly, like in the same building. Gentrification can also be about a kind of concurrent prioritizing and deprioritizing, which I think is what's happening in Detroit. So if you look at this area called the 7.2, which is the 7.2 square miles of the greater downtown, that's where essentially the city has fostered a development free-for-all, has sold buildings at bargain basement prices, and has also poured in the little money it has and little attention it has to quote-unquote revitalize it. Meanwhile, Detroit in general, the whole thing is, I think, something like 145 square miles. So this is 7.2 square miles that, you know, when every New York Times reporter comes to Detroit and declares the city reborn, when every politician speaks about, you know, turning a new chapter in Detroit's history, they're talking about 7.2 out of 144 square miles. And in the rest of the city, you know, until a few years ago, there weren't streetlights. There wasn't regular garbage collection. Water has been shut off to tens of thousands of households. And because the county refuses to tax people at appropriate rates, people who live in a house worth $10,000 are often paying $10,000 a year in taxes to the county, going into tax foreclosure, being kicked out of the city, and then those houses are being flipped and sold to new residents, or just held off market until those neighborhoods become more gentrified. So yeah, and there's also this kind of like ecosystem for the 7.2 where there's a nonprofit media network that, you know, profiles every new business. There's nonprofits that give grants to new businesses. There are tax breaks and government incentives for opening new businesses and redeveloping real estate. And that kind of just creates this bubble of wealth and whiteness that's almost completely separate from the rest of the city. In the core of downtown, Dan Gilbert, who is the owner of Quicken Loans, which is one of the largest mortgage companies in the country, now owns, I think when I wrote the book, it was something like 65 buildings, now owns 90 buildings in downtown Detroit. And most of them are skyscrapers, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 stories, and has converted almost all of them either into high-end offices or lofts that are renting for prices that you usually associate with Brooklyn or San Francisco. And people are calling that neighborhood Gilbertville because he has his own private security force that works with the Detroit police. And he owns so many of these buildings that it's essentially his town that he controls. So yeah, there's this essentially privatized core of a city surrounded by a gentrified outer core. And then everything else is essentially left to go to seed.
It's a real dystopian vision that one would hardly believe in fiction, but it's reality.
Yeah, speaking of dystopian, one of the people who I profile in the book, Lauren Hood, whose parents were kind of like the typical middle class of Detroit. You know, her dad worked for one of the car companies. Her mom worked at a decent paying state job, and they lived in one of the outer neighborhoods, and then they were robbed and the cops never came, and so they ended up moving to a suburb where they felt safe. And now Lauren Hood, you know, she's one of the few African Americans who can afford to live in the 7.2. But we were driving between the outer neighborhood where her parents used to live and the 7.2. And yeah, speaking of dystopia, she was just like, sometimes I feel like we live in the Hunger Games where like we're going back into the capital and everything else is sealed around the borders.
Now, Peter Moskowitz, in this book, How to Kill a City, you also talk about how to truly not kill a city, how to revive a city, how to make a city more what it was supposed to be, at least in Jane Jacobs' vision. Talk about some of the solutions.
Sure. So I do think we have a long road ahead, and I do think we have to aim high, because we're not just talking about building a new subway line or a new park or adding on a few public housing units. We need large actions for things to really change. Yeah, and in the back of the book, I have some direct and kind of, in my view, implementable suggestions that could be implemented if there was political will to do it. And that would that starts with things like protecting public land, not selling it off to developers. And that can even include things like closing down certain streets or narrowing them. Something like 30% of all land in New York City is roads. And to me, that's a huge waste of space. That includes things like higher taxes on the rich to fund things like public housing. It includes things like universal rent control, which might seem like a pipe dream, but many cities in Europe have it. Berlin just passed it. New York City had rent control that applied to every building built before, I forget what exact year, but sometime in the 1960s. And there's no reason except a lack of political will that something like that couldn't happen again.
You know, I heard you speak on the Leonard Lopate show, and you said something that pricked my ears up, and it's why I wanted to invite you on Writer's Voice. But I felt like it wasn't really, you know, it wasn't gone into in more depth by the host. And that is that the central problem we're really talking about here is neoliberal capitalism. It is a systemic problem. So I guess in the last few minutes, sum it all up for us, how this relates fundamentally to our economic system, and, you know, what are the levers we need to apply to change that?
Right. So I think when I start talking about this, a lot of people get panicky or their eyes glaze over because it seems like the problem's so large. How would you ever, you know, how would you ever address it? But I think you have to talk about this problem in order to find the correct solution and realize that the correct solution is not tweaks to the tax code, but it's something much larger. But to me, that's also helpful because people have been fighting for the things I'm about to talk about for years and years, and there's already, you know, movements against these things. So, yeah, if you look at all of U.S. history, in my view, you can consider it a kind of story of displacement and capital gain through displacement. The massacre of Native Americans, you know, gaining money through privatization of land that belonged to other people, right? Slavery was the same thing. If you look at redlining in the 1940s and 50s, where the government literally said, if black people live in a certain neighborhood, banks are not allowed to lend to that neighborhood. What was that a way of doing? That was a way of ensuring that white people could build housing wealth through owning private property in the suburbs and completely disenfranchising other people. And that's why if you look at monetary inequality now, it's worse than it was 40 years ago. It's worse than it was 50 years ago because the government made a purposeful decision to gift some people wealth in the form of housing and land and block other people from having the same thing. So these are the huge problems we're facing. These are hundreds-year-long timelines we're talking about when it comes to housing discrimination, when it comes to displacement. And the root of the problem is that housing is a commodity. And, you know, I hate bringing up Marx and Engels in interviews, because then people are going to roll their eyes and just be like, oh, another Marxist. But you know, Engels had a book called The Housing Question, and, you know, 150 years ago, essentially foresaw what was going to happen, that if housing was a commodity, that the closer housing was to the center of a city, the more it would be worth. And if housing wasn't made available for the poor, they would be relegated to take housing in the outer parts of cities. He didn't call them suburbs, obviously, because suburbs weren't a thing. But he basically predicted what's happening in every city right now. And that's because of this root problem. We don't consider housing a human right. We don't consider housing political at all. I mean, it wasn't even mentioned once during the presidential debates, right? So, and yeah, what movements can you think of that are really about housing? There, as far as I know, there's not one mainstream movement about housing or neighborhoods in the U.S. right now. Compare that to a place like Berlin, which is going through its own gentrification crisis, and it's not rare, essentially every month, to have tens of thousands of people on the street protesting in favor of rent control, in favor of stopping development in certain neighborhoods and things like that. So I do think we have a long road ahead in terms of people just haven't even started thinking of housing politically yet in this country. But once that happens, I think the good thing is you'll realize there are organizations and people who have been working on this all along, that while gentrification is a new form of this process, there have been people fighting housing discrimination, there have been people fighting racial discrimination and income inequality for years and years, and that linking up with those fights is really the way to fight this gentrification problem.
Well, it's a really a terrific book, How to Kill a City, Gentrification, Inequality, and the Fight for the Neighborhood. Peter Moskowitz, thank you so much for talking with us here about it.
Thanks for having me.
Peter Moskowitz. You can read an excerpt from How to Kill a City by going to writersvoice.net. But before going there, you can hear Moskowitz read an excerpt from the book.
So this is from the last part of the book, which is about New York, where I'm from, and just about a walk that I took one day, you know, from the West Village through the East Village over the Williamsburg Bridge and kind of to the neighborhood that I lived in at the time in Brooklyn. And just like realizing, I think I say at some point in this chapter, that the only time I can really process how monumental these changes are is when I'm alone and just kind of able to take in the massiveness of what's happened to my old neighborhood. So, yeah, I'm just going through these memories that I have in this section. I remember the day a gay guy moved out who lived in my parents' buildings since I was born. The village was no longer the gayborhood, so what was the reason to stay? Soon after, the remaining artists in the building were gone. The monthly maintenance in the building had gone up. There were almost no more art supply stores or galleries downtown. Then some of the professional yuppie types left. What's the point of living in a relatively cramped place instead of the suburbs if they increasingly provide the exact same things? And then even some of the rich left. Gentrification has a way of creeping up on you. The white, hippie-ish middle class doesn't notice when the black queer kids go missing. The professionals don't notice or don't care when the hippies leave. The rich don't notice when the young professionals leave. And then you're left with the Village Today, an upscale mall for international oligarchs.
That was Peter Moskowitz reading an excerpt from How to Kill a City. And you can read another one by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, the Mulberry Street Gang. Stay tuned. You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We've been talking about gentrification in a number of major U.S. cities today, including New York. One of the first New York City neighborhoods to gentrify was Soho. As listeners heard, gentrification got started there when the city government pushed industry out and allowed artists in. But as real estate values rose, most of the artists left to be replaced by upscale national chain stores like Nike and Bloomingdale's. The neighborhood is still churning, but on rare occasions, that churn opens up a small space for something remarkable to happen.
More screws? Here. Grab the next one.
I got screws.
Like the pop-up exhibit I saw being installed while walking on East Houston Street between Mulberry and Mott. The lot where the exhibit is located is up for sale, but for the next 4 months, it will play host to a collection of remarkable posters illustrating the history of what it calls the Mulberry Street Gang. No, not MS-13, but real visionaries, some of them household names like Teddy Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and Nikola Tesla, along with two of their lesser-known but no less history-making buddies, Joseph Kepler and Jacob Riis. In fact, here on this show, we have a debt to pay to Tesla. He invented the radio right across from the exhibit. The Mulberry Street Gang pop-up is the brainchild of Stephen Stolman. He's the former owner of the site on Houston Street and moved into the building, now gone, that was on the site some 30 years ago. He hopes to shine a light on the little-known history that happened here at the turn of the 20th century. I sat down with Steve Stolman to find out more about it.
My name is Steve Stolman. I occupied this space for 33 years. I left here about 8 years ago.
So, first of all, when you say here, where are we? And what is the significance of this place?
Well, we're at 49 East Houston Street. It's between Mott and Mulberry Streets in New York City. It used to be Chinatown. Now it's Nolita. It used to be the Bowery. Now it's a very fancy neighborhood. And it's gentrified quite a bit in the last 5 to 10 years. When I was here, it was more working class and mixed population of Chinese, Dominican, all kinds of different people. These days, it's very hard to afford the rents here. So you have a traditional population, and you have a lot of people who have moved in more recently.
And what's the significance of the spot that we're on right here?
Well, this spot, 49 East Houston Street, was, for instance, directly across the street from 48 East Houston Street, which was the laboratory of a fellow named Nikola Tesla, who was sort of the Leonardo da Vinci of our time, invented a good deal of the 21st century. Wireless communication. Everybody grab your cell phone and call your friends and tell them that this is the man who actually made it possible. An alternating current and energy that doesn't take coal and oil. We have Niagara Falls, 80% of our good energy comes from Niagara Falls, which he invented. He saw it in a dream when he was a kid, this water going over this falls, and he invented the induction motor. He invented AC current, which allowed the energy to be transmitted over long distances. Thomas Edison had DC current, and Tesla was in a famous war with him over whether AC or DC was going to prevail. And he said Edison just didn't understand what AC was. He didn't have the intellectual capacity to realize what was going on. And there's obviously a much superior form of energy. And he actually demonstrated it at the 1893 Chicago Exposition, which was the same place he had this. He lit it up with AC current. He showed that nobody was going to get electrocuted and it was good light. And that happened to be the same place where Puck magazine had the official publication of the fair, was there during that entire year. And that's one of the connections between Puck, which was here on the corner, and Tesla, who was across the street. And then there were these other characters who were around here. One of them was Mark Twain, because he was a good friend of Tesla, used to hang out with him. And another person was Jacob Riis, wrote a book called How the Other Half Lives, which I think today would be How the Other 99% Lives. And he also was a pioneer in the use of flash photography. You could not shoot at night, but he started using magnesium and phosphorus, whatever it was, and he demonstrated that you could actually shoot photographs at night and get them published in newspapers. And before that time, it was mostly illustrations.
Wow. So you had Mark Twain, Nikola Tesla, Teddy Roosevelt.
Teddy Roosevelt was the chief of police. He came here in 1898, and it turned out the police headquarters was the center of all crime activity in New York. It was pre-mafia. And if you wanted to do something illegal, you connected, you talked to the people in the police department. So they got Teddy Roosevelt. He was supposed to clean up the act, which to some extent he did. He fired some people, and he did to some extent improve the situation. But the important thing is that while he was here, Jacob Riis was across the street, was a police reporter for the Sun, and he took him around with him as his bodyguard. So he took him to all the places, the most disreputable imaginable places, which Roosevelt, of course, had no experience with whatsoever. And it transformed him. It changed him into a social crusader. When he became president by accident, you know, they made him vice president because they wanted to get rid of him. So they made him McKinley's vice president, and then McKinley went up to Buffalo and got himself shot all of a sudden Roosevelt's the president of the United States. And he had been infected with these ideas, Puck, anti-monopoly, anti-corruption, Jacob Riis, showing how badly people were being treated. And he absorbed all this stuff when he became president. All of a sudden, he went after the trusts. You know, he made all these national parks for people. Roosevelt was a kind of a complicated character, and he definitely did some stuff in his life that was fairly despicable. By the same token, compared with the politicians at that time, he was a progressive. He started a progressive party. And he brought all these ideas forward that probably he acquired while he was down in this neighborhood.
As we heard, on the corner of Mulberry and Houston Street is the magnificent Puck Building, once the proud home of one of America's most innovative and muckraking publications, Puck Magazine, founded, edited, and illustrated by Joseph Kepler.
Kepler was the person, the immigrant, who started Puck Magazine in the 1860s. He was from Austria, and he was actually involved in theater. And apparently part of theater is you painted the scenes, and he discovered that he was actually a pretty good painter. So he became the publisher, the editor. There's a guy named Schwartzman who was technically the publisher, but he became, in effect, the publisher. And he hooked up with a company called Ottman, and they learned to perfect cheap color printing on cheap paper, cheap lithography on newsprint. So you could print a paper like Puck, beautiful full-color paper, and charge 10 cents for it. And the first issue that they published in 1877 was 10 cents. The last issue they published in 1917 was 10 cents. Puck did it, in a sense, to bring the working class into the picture. And that's why pictures were so important, because you didn't even have to understand the words. You could see what was going on. You could see the kind of characters who were being parodied. And it gave people strength. It gave people courage. It gave people the realization that they didn't have to be crushed by somebody who claimed to have some dominion over them. So these were important publications in terms of our whole national psyche. Who are we? What are we? What are we supposed to respect? What are we supposed to know? How much do you have to know in order to be able to understand what's going on? These all became important questions. And yes, Kepler sold the ads, wrote the copy, drew the pictures. They invented the magazine, the modern magazine. They had the first display advertising. And so it was really, he invented the comic, color comic book. So here's somebody, an immigrant artist, who had a phenomenal influence over our political life, over our cultural life, yet nobody knows he even existed. It's not taught in school. You're not taught that an immigrant artist can get presidents unelected or get corporations or trusts busted. We're not taught that in school.
Steve Stolman has selected from among his collection of Kepler's brilliant political cartoons and blown them up to poster size for passers-by to view. I asked him to describe some of them.
This over here is Grant, all about U.S. Grant. They didn't like Grant very much. They thought he was stupid and corrupt. And here he is being blown over by public opinion. This is, he's hanging on to a smokestack. It's called the Republican Party, but it ain't going to save him, because public opinion is blowing, and it's blowing so hard that it's gonna knock him off the roof. And this other one here is Puck. Here's the headline on this: A Good Beginning, Puck to French Justice. So far, so good, Madame. You have vindicated Dreyfus, but you must punish those criminals who persecuted him before your work is done. There's a picture of Justice with blindfold, and Puck standing there with the name of all the characters who were also complicit in the Dreyfus case, but who were never prosecuted. And so this was about New York politics, it was about national politics, it was about international politics, it was about war making, it was about morality. It changed a lot. There were different artists, you know, that came through, and of course they had different points of view. And when they started, another publication called Judge began a couple of years later. They stole off some of the artists. They tried to co-op it, as often the establishment does when there's something that comes up. They couldn't do it because they were so powerful and people were so loyal to them that they prevailed for 40 years. And so it was phenomenally valuable, really. We need that today. The headline yesterday was the president is about to squash the First Amendment. Yeah, who needs the First Amendment? Well, we need the First Amendment. We need it really badly. But we need people to exercise their freedom of expression in order for it to mean something. And these guys did it more powerfully and better than almost anybody in history. And yet, Nobody knows who they are, what they are. It's a big secret. It shouldn't be a secret. It should be some of our proudest moments, certainly some of our proudest journalism.
The Mulberry Street Gang exhibit argues that these five men, Kepler, Twain, Tesla, Rees, and Roosevelt, changed not only American history, but also the way we talk about it.
The thing is, to me, they all did the same thing. They all created a new medium because they wanted to be able to change the world, especially in a way that made it fairer to the average person. And they realized that regular language wasn't going to do it. They had to come up with something else. So Puck came up with colored pictures, and Rees came up with photographs at night. And, you know, all these guys, Tesla came up with radio and television.
And Mark Twain came up with...
Well, Mark Twain, I call the first stand-up comedian. He came up with... guys, guess what? You know, Colbert and Jon Stewart, people who live to be able to show the real impact and the real nature of what's going on around them instead of the pretend superficial nonsense. And Puck did that magnificently and set the stage for Mad Magazine, for Jon Stewart, for whoever is up there who is willing to take on the powers that be and demonstrate... You know, the powers that be are not the powers that be, the powers that pretend to be.
And that was Stephen Stolman. If you're in New York City, you can go to 49 East Houston Street over the next 4 months to view the exhibition for yourself, or you can go to writersvoice.net to see my photos of the Mulberry Street Gang exhibit. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.